And good morning and welcome to Writers on Writing on 88.9 KUCI FM. We're broadcasting from the University of California Irvine campus and we're on the web at KUCI.org and iTunes College Radio. Today is Wednesday, November 13th, 2013. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett and our guests today are Alex Forbes, Jennifer Kaufman, and Karen Mack. First half hour, I will be with Alex Forbes, who is a songwriter and has quite a lot of experience with songwriting. And I'll go into her bio in a second. And in the second half, Nicole Nelson will be here with Jennifer Kaufman and Karen Mack talking about their novel, Freud's Mistress. So we're doing two new things today, actually. One is we've never had a songwriter on before in like 15 years. And the other is we are talking to, or Nicole will be talking to co-authors, and we've never done that either. So, we didn't realize in putting the show together that we were doing two, firsts, but we are. And that's exciting. So anyway, first up is Alex Forbes. Alex co-leads the Songwriters Forum in the Master's Songwriting Program at NYU's Steinhardt School and teaches courses at Gotham Writers Workshop, which is how I found out about her because I also teach there. And she has spoken on panels at ASCAP, the Recording Academy, the Connecticut Songwriters Association, and the Austin Songwriters Group. She's led workshops for many school groups and received an ASCAP Foundation grant to teach an after-school songwriting course at the Institute for Collaborative Education, an alternative public school in New York City. Alex received a creative writing degree from Stanford University. She's author of Write Songs Right Now and the forthcoming Song Lab, both published by AudioGo, the home of BBC Audiobooks. Hey, Alex.
Hey.
Good to see you.
Great to have you
on the show. You know, when I was reading your bio earlier this morning, quite earlier this morning, actually, probably 3 a.m, I saw that you have a degree from Stanford in creative writing, and I started wondering how that took you from what I imagine, I am probably wrong, but imagine, writing books, writing stories, writing in some other genre that probably the creative writing program was more in tune with and going into the direction of songwriting.
Well, for me, it's funny you ask that because I was there in the 70s and they didn't have a lyric writing degree, as you can imagine, but they did have a degree you could get in with a concentration in poetry. So that was as close as I could come at Stanford back then to getting closer to songwriting. So I would ask my poetry class teachers, would you mind if I brought in a lyric? And they were like, okay. So I ended up using it in that regard. And of course, you know, getting familiar with the language is a huge part of studying to get any degree or reading or writing or anything. So it definitely moved me forward, but actually writing songs is a different thing than writing poetry.
Well, that I was going to say that because I've written poetry, I've had a little bit published, and I feel like I cannot write a song to save my life. And I live with musicians, my son writes songs, my husband's a musician. But to me, that's the one genre I don't think I have ever written a song.
Well, it's interesting. Having written poetry and having written songs, I would say the big difference comes down to form. And song form is pretty simple. You've heard songs all your life, but you might never have taken them apart to see the moving pieces. And, you know, what I was taught when I was coming up was there are 3 song forms. And there's the AAA, which is the simplest song form, sort of like Happy Birthday or Ring Around the Rosie, that have one moving part. And then there's AABA, which are slightly more complicated in that they go into a B section and come back, the classic one being Yesterday by the Beatles.
Mm-hmm.
The B section being the part where it goes, why she had to go. And then the third part, which is the most common these days, is the verse-chorus song. And poetry doesn't really work that way. You can have your free verse, you can have your, you know, couplets and your stanzas and that sort of thing, but that amount of repetition that occurs in a song is what makes it so catchy and so memorable.
Hmm. Yeah, that's interesting. It's, I guess, like you, as you said, like any form, you need to learn the forms, and it's one thing I've never done.
It's not hard. You know, I think that a lot of poets out there would be great songwriters because they have an appreciation for rhyme and meter and language and form in general. I mean, a poem has to be poured into a form. You could take those similar ideas and pour them into a song form.
Are most songwriters musicians? Do you feel like you have to be a musician to be a songwriter?
No, definitely not. One of my mentors was a guy named Doc Pomus, and he was really strictly a lyricist. You look at a lot of the partnerships in the world of songwriting who have achieved great things, and some of them are really lyric people, and they team up. And that's the beauty, like we were saying about the co-authoring of a novel. I was excited to hear that because songwriting is often collaborative, I'd say more often than not, especially if you want to achieve some degree of success. It's hard to do everything yourself and be good at everything yourself. It's actually not hard to do it. It's hard to be great at all the aspects of lyric and music. So if you can team up with someone who can supplement your skills right there, it's a great way to go. I've seen incredible stuff happen when a great lyricist meets up with the Lennon to their McCartney.
Yeah, interesting. I'm curious, you know, just as in, say, novel writing or short story writing or memoir writing, the advice is read memoirs if that's what you want to write, read novels if that's what you're going to, if you want to write. And yeah, we have been, I mean, everybody's listened to music growing up and throughout their lives, but are there particular songs or composers or songwriters that, if you want to write songs, you really should study or listen to? Or, you know, should you just listen to and study whatever is of your time?
That's a great question. I think different people need to go about it different ways. But for me, I love the classics. I grew up on 60s music, especially, you know, when music really, really moved the world forward, you know, politically and socially, social consciousness raising. I came of age in those days. You know, Bob Dylan, Joni Mitchell, Crosby, Stills, and Nash, you know, people voicing their thoughts about the war and racism and all, you know, all sorts of social issues. Those are great songs. And then there's other people who might rather listen to what moves them right now, in the here and now. I think, I don't really want to say that there's a right way to go about it, but I do think you need to know the roots in a way. Mm-hmm. But you don't want to be ignorant. You want to come at it from a point of, you know, knowledge, but I wouldn't want to bang anyone over the head and say, you must listen to Bob Dylan if that's really not your thing.
sure. You are listening to Writers on Writing, and I am with Alex Forbes. Her book is Write Songs Right Now, and her website, actually, I think you have two websites, yeah?
Yeah, I'd say the more relevant one to this is creativesongwriter.com.
Yeah, and that's a great place to go if you want more info on her book, on even, you know, consulting with Alex, or it's just such a great website. There's so much here to, you could spend a few hours here. And I see that you do song critiques, and I'm curious about that because, you know, again, in writing and in writing novels or short stories or memoir, you tend to be in a critique group or you have people read your stuff. And when you critique a song, what are you looking for or listening to? Are you mostly paying attention to the lyrics? Are you paying attention to how the lyrics work with the music? How do you do that?
Great question. All of the above. I will work with whatever people bring, because some people may be writing their very first songs, and those might consist of what I call song starts. They might consist of a chorus that has no verses, or it might be just a straight lyric with no music to it yet. And whatever people give me, I look for the gems. There's always something buried in there that's fantastic, and usually it's in the company of something that might not be up on that level. And my job as a coach is to point out what the diamonds are, what the coal is, you know, to either exorcise the coal and go straight for the diamonds, or use that song as a stepping stone to greater things. Like, for example, if someone sends me a lyric and there's five amazing lines and 18 lines, not so great, we'll really look at what was great about those five amazing lines and see if it's worth bringing up the other 18 or starting a whole new song that really brings, you know, like, let's say it has a great title and a great chorus, but the verse lyrics aren't really working so well.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's my job, is to point to what's working, what's not working, and whether what you want to leave by the wayside and take from that piece, whatever it is. And same with music. It's like, if one part of the song is great and the other part,
mm-hmm.
You know, we try and just bring it up to an amazing level. Or, as I said, some songs are more stepping stones. They're kind of lessons in what doesn't work, and you kind of want to cut bait and move on from them. I write a lot of those myself. So.
Mm-hmm. And in your book, you talk about, you know, writing a lot. I mean, it's so much the same in other genres, you know, writing a lot, throwing a lot of words against the wall before any start sticking. And then at a certain point, focusing on quality, focusing on the content.
Yeah.
Will you talk about that?
Sure, sure. My little motto is dare to fail, or, you know, another way of putting it. And it's basically to fearlessly go forward and express yourself without, you know, turning down the volume. I don't know if you can turn it off, but you can turn down the volume of that critical voice that's going, no, this isn't good enough, that's mm-hmm. not right. And just sort of tuning that out for however long you're going to write, whether it's 10 minutes or an hour, and just blurting it all out, whatever is real, whatever is true. And then going back and circling back and starting to put your ideas into a form. But first, you really almost have to get it off your chest. A lot of times when I'm collaborating with someone, I will interview them about an idea they have and just write down every single thing they say, and then go back and pick through it and find those little diamonds in the rough that we could start to put into a song form. That's one way of going about it. Another way is to just jam on your instrument or sing into a recorder and then see what sticks. It's the same idea. Generate, quantity, and then discern what the quality is.
Mm. Do you find that songwriters tend toward a particular song form? I mean, you talked about the three song forms, and I'm thinking of, you know, writers like, Joni Mitchell or Bruce Springsteen, which, you know, his name comes up a lot when people talk about storytelling songs, you know, or, mm-hmm. or who am I thinking, Steely Dan, you know, where
sure.
they're telling stories. And is it sort of like, again, with other genres, you know, some writers write mysteries, some writers write literary fiction. Is that how it is with songwriters, too, where songwriters have a tendency to one of the forms or another? Or
well, I would just say, if you're at all looking to hold people's attention in the commercial sense, and you want a big payoff, you would probably tend to go for the verse-chorus form, because it has a chorus, and the beauty of a chorus is that it sticks in people's heads and it resonates, you know, across the ages if you do it right.
Mm-hmm.
And the other two song forms, the problem with an AAA form is, like, look at 99 bottles of beer on the wall. No one ever gets all the way back down to one. They usually get to, like, 97 and they get tired of it. It's just, it's not that, it doesn't hold the attention
mm-hmm.
for much longer. So those songs tend to be very short. There are some great ones in that form, don't get me wrong. You know, Amazing Grace, or the song The Rose, you know, the one that goes, mm-hmm. Some say love it is a,
mm-hmm.
et cetera. That song, you know, that's a beautiful song in the AAA form, but it's hard for me to find examples of those that are coming out these days that are making an impact. And same with AABA songs. I have to really look hard to find one that has been successful. One is the Green Day song, Wake Me Up When September Ends.
Mm.
That's an AABA song. But really, I have to, you know, comb the charts to find one that's that's been commercially viable. But the verse chorus song, there, it's everywhere. It's almost all of the songs you can think of.
Mm-hmm. That's interesting. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Okay. You know, this is like a little mini workshop we're having here, because now I'm going to be listening to songs a little differently. What about, you know, you brought something up about, you said commercial, you know, the verse chorus form is the best for commercial purposes. And on this show, we always talk about the business of writing. And so I'm curious, in terms of the commercial aspect of songwriting, what the likelihood is of selling songs to established songwriters. Because it would seem to me that if you want to be a songwriter or you want to make a living doing music, that would be one way, if you write good songs, that you place them rather than maybe trying to be the famous musician yourself.
Well, right. And I just love to give people the my little spiel, which is the only way people are going to want to buy your music is to write something that moves an audience. And however big that audience is, you might just be moving, you know, your best friend and your dog, or it might spread out to, you know, you get a sort of a circle of support that is your fan base or whatever. And then beyond that, if you want to get a song to another artist, I mean, it has to be above and beyond what they could have written themselves. And for me, that's the big challenge, is to write something and then record it to within an inch of its life that actually makes people go, oh my gosh, I never could have written that. That is so amazing. I wish I wrote that, but I didn't, and I need to put that on my album.
Mm-hmm.
So that's you see what I'm saying? Like, there are little waves you make, and however far you spread them, it really depends on that initial spark of inspiration you had, and then the form that you put that spark in. How far can that spread? It's like is it a little pebble that dropped into the water and made a little circumference, or does it have the power to move people who actually start to see dollar signs in their eyeballs when they hear your song?
Mm-hmm.
And you can't actually, on that subject of seeing dollars in their eyeballs, if you're writing trying to give people dollars in their eyeballs, you usually end up with a really terrible song.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas if you're writing something that actually moves you in your heart of hearts, there's more likelihood that if you put it in a brilliant song form, that it will generate that excitement. But trying to do it, I've failed many a time.
Mm-hmm. But you've also you've also placed songs, which is impressive. And so what's the bridge then? So say you've written some stuff, people hear it, you go to whatever critiques, and there's a lot of those that seem to go on out here in LA, and you get good responses to your stuff. Then what's the next step? I mean, how would you get it to someone that is right now, you know, on the charts or performing, touring? How would they ever hear it?
Well, that's, you know, it's not like there's one way, and that's what I tell a lot of my one-on-one clients. It's like sometimes they're asking me, what do you do? And it's more like, what each song has if you look at a song, like, it has it's almost like a little person. It has a lifespan. It has a destiny. And your job is to tell which of these song babies that you give birth to is worth taking to the degree of investing the money. Because for me, I don't know how much it costs out there, but in New York here, it costs me between $1,000 and more dollars to get a song professionally to, like, to the level of a master, where
mm-hmm.
it sounds like what's on the radio. It sounds like what's on a TV show or in a film. And I would only want to suggest that people spend that money if and when they write a song that deserves it. So, like I said, some of them will, some of them won't. But let's say you wrote one that you think does, and that everybody you play it. Let's see, to me, what happened was I was in a songwriting class, and I'd been writing for 7 years or so, and I wrote one song that I could not sleep that night. I was like, oh, my God, oh, my God, oh, my God. And then I brought it to my class, and everybody didn't pick it to pieces in the critique. They all said, that one's it.
Mm-hmm.
And I knew it in my heart that I'd written one that was it. And so I took that song and demoed it, I think, three times. I demoed it once in my little home studio on a cassette. Boy, those were the days. And then I brought it to one place and got it demoed, and it wasn't good enough. And I brought it to the third place, and I spent what was the equivalent then of 2 months' rent to demo that song. And so it was hurting me financially, but I believed in the song. And then when I brought that song around, because it was a diamond and not a chunk of coal, it got the attention. So do you see what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. It all comes from, is the song good enough? Then if the song is good enough, the demo needs to be good enough, or the master recording needs to be good enough. And then if that's good enough, you can start bringing it to places where people are in need of what you're offering.
Mm-hmm. And you have a lot of that in your book, it looks like. It looks like you have a lot of resources back here, you know, after you go through writing songs and the forms and you know, on and on. There's a good chunk back here on just resources.
Well, yeah, because, you know, it's the most wonderful thing about this digital revolution, even though it's changed the entire paradigm and pulled the rug out from under the way things used to work, is that actually if you have a great song now, you can find a lot of places and resources to help you take that next step. I want to provide some of those resources, but it's a big world, and it's almost a level playing field in some respects, because there's so many ways to find each other and form a community. And LA is, you know, just a melting pot of incredible talent. And we're not, as I said, it takes a village. You know, we're not in this alone. We're in this together. And if we can find a community that supports us and feeds us, and that we bring something to the party, it's really exciting what you can do.
Mm. We are at the end of our time, and I wonder if you have any advice for our listeners who may be interested in songwriting, or if there are a couple of songs or a song that you feel is just like the most perfect song ever written, that inspires you over and over again.
In terms of advice, I would say look for the song in your soul. To me, that if I'm speaking to some writers out there, I would say we all have a song in our soul. Or a series of songs in our soul, and just try the form. It's a beautifully simple form, and a song is 3 minutes long. If you're doing it right, it's about 3 or 4 minutes long. It's not as gigantic of a task as writing a novel. So I would say go for it, and I'm happy to, you know, speak with anybody, you know, free for, you know, 15 minutes, a half an hour, and see if I can provide any resources that would help you get to that point. I'm committed to people writing great music. And as for a favorite song, I would say Otis Redding
mm-hmm.
wrote Respect.
Mm.
What a great song.
Yeah, what a great song. So true.
Well, thank you so much.
Thank you. And I want to say again that you teach at Gotham Writers Workshop, and that's very cool, having an online songwriting class. And
Actually, it's not online.
It's not?
My class through Gotham is in person.
So you have to be in New York. Okay.
It's a one-day workshop.
Okay. Well,
but
then.
People are welcome to, you know, get a hold of me for online, anything.
Excellent. Thank you so much, Alex.
Have a beautiful day, everybody.
You too. That was Alex Forbes, and her website is Creative Songwriter. Oh, see here, I'm going to mess up now. Oh, yeah. Anyway, she's Alex Forbes. I just Googled her, and you will find her at the top of your screen if you Google Alex Forbes Songwriter. And there's two websites that you can find her through. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, Nicole Nelson will be here with Jennifer Kaufman and Karen Mack and their book, Freud's Mistress. And I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett. Take a look at penonfire.com if you're interested in the Pen on Fire speaker series. Next week we have a party for USA Noir for the launch of the book. And I want to thank again everyone who donated last week to the fundraiser. We're so helpful in keeping this show on the air. And you all know who you are. I've thanked you a few times. And I won't bore you and embarrass you who are listening, who donated, one more time. But anyway, we're going to take a quick break. We'll be right back. Stay tuned for Writers on Writing, second half.
Come back, baby, please don't go. No, I love you, darling, hate to see you go. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time. My heart's full of sorrow, mama aching tears. Be gone 24 hours, child, seem like a thousand years. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time. Darling, one month better than a day. Let's talk it over before you go away. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time.
I lost my mojo.
I lost it. Where'd it go?
I don't know, but I found it. I found it on Writers on Writing.
Writers on Writing?
Wednesday mornings at 9. 9 a.m. in the morning.
With Barbara DeMarco Barrett and Marie Stone?
That's them.
The views and opinions expressed on this program do not necessarily represent those of KUCI, its management, or the UC Board of Regents. For more information on this or other KUCI programs, visit kuci.org or kucitalk.org.
Hello, and welcome back to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We're broadcasting live from the University of California campus in Irvine and streaming on the web at kuci.org. The show will join the other interviews up on the web and available to you via podcast. You can always visit Barbara's website, penonfire.com, for direct downloads, as well as information on past shows, upcoming shows, speaker series events, and more. I'm your guest host, Nicole Nelson. I'd like to introduce co-novelists Karen Mack and Jennifer Kaufman. Karen Mack is a former attorney. She has produced many films and television productions, including the Golden Globe, Christopher, and Emmy Award-winning One Against the Wind, a Hallmark Hall of Fame presentation. For the past 14 years, she has been executive producer of A Home for the Holidays, an annual CBS network special, which promotes foster care adoption. A Home for the Holidays won the 2008 Television Academy Honors, an award given out by the Academy of Television Arts and Sciences. Jennifer Kaufman is a former staff writer for the Los Angeles Times and a two-time winner of the National Penny, Missouri Journalism Award. She spent 3 years as bureau chief for Fairchild Publications, Women's Wear Daily, and W Magazine in Milan and Rome. Prior to that, she worked for Fairchild Publications in New York, covering business, film, and features. She was formerly a staff reporter for the Baltimore News American and the Prince George's County Sentinel in Bethesda, Maryland. Karen and Jennifer have co-authored two previous books together. Literacy and Longing was on the LA Times bestseller list for 15 weeks, and their second novel, A Version of the Truth, also reached the LA Times bestseller list. Their new book, Freud's Mistress, is now available, published by Putnam's Amy Einhorn Books. This is their first time on the show, and I am pleased to welcome them to Writers on Writing. Karen and Jennifer, welcome.
Thank you. We're very happy to be on the show.
Thank you.
Karen and Jennifer?
Yes, thank you. Good morning.
Okay. I'm going to play some music, and we're going to Be right back.
Come back, baby, please don't go. No, I love you, darling, hate to see you go.
I apologize. Karen and Jennifer, thank you so much for being on the show.
Thank you. We're very happy to be here.
Great. And we find that no one introduces a book better than the author or authors. Could you tell us about your book?
Well, this is Karen speaking, and how it started was Jennifer and I were just finishing our second book, and we read an article in the New York Times Magazine, and it was about Sigmund Freud, and it was about the sister-in-law who lived with him for 42 years. And I remember reading years ago the Mina question, as it was called, as fascinated scholars for the past century. Did Sigmund Freud or did he not have an affair with his sister-in-law? But all the serious historians had dismissed it. They said as revolutionary as Freud was in his research, he was ultra-conservative in his own life, and it would have been totally out of character. And that was until 2006 or 7, which is when about we first read this article, when a German sociologist decided to follow the Freud trail. And in the summer of 1896, Freud was around 42, and he was very handsome. And at this point, he wasn't the Freud that people envision when they think of Sigmund Freud. He's a very dynamic guy. And he took a trip to Switzerland with his sister-in-law, Nina Bernays, which was very common in those days. People would travel with relatives, and she was considered a sister, not a sister-in-law. And the sociologist, he was a prolific letter writer, and he had written a postcard home saying, Mina and I are in this lovely little pension, and the glaciers are beautiful. So this sociologist went to this hotel, and the hotel was still standing, but it wasn't a little pension. It was a huge, grand hotel. And he thought, well, that's strange that Freud had lied about that to his wife. And then he went home, and he came back again, and he said, do you still have the old hotel logs? And they went in the basement and found the old hotel log from the date of the postcard, which was in 1895. And sure enough, there was the famous signature, Dr. Sigmund Freud and Frau. So he had signed her in as his wife, and they were in a double room with one bed. So even all the historians who had doubted it, that was sort of the smoking gun. And that was when all the articles were in the paper about, you know, did the greatest figure in history to explain human sexuality and desire, was he himself caught up in a scandalous love affair at the very time he was making these discoveries? And in addition, it wasn't just any love affair. It was with his wife's younger sister. So it was irresistible to Jennifer and I, and we both started doing research on it.
Yes, and so this was a jump for both of you because your first two novels had a contemporary setting, but you agreed to take this leap into the historical and all of that entailed, like a lot of research. And
I don't think we truly understood how much research it was entailed, because when we first started doing it, we were sort of thinking, oh, this is an interesting time period, but we had three concentric circles of research. We had to find out all about the period, which is Fin de Siècle Vienna, which is every bit as interesting as the Downton Abbey age in England. So that was fascinating, and everything that was going on there. And then there was the characters that were involved in this ménage à trois, and one of whom happened to be Sigmund Freud. So then we had to learn about what he was working on during this period, all his theories during this specific period that the affair took place. So there was a huge amount of research. Jennifer went to Vienna. I went to London to the Freud Museum. So it was much bigger than either one of us had anticipated. Don't you feel that way, Jennifer?
Yeah, we also we ordered a lot of books having to do with his letters. We read letters that he wrote to his family, to Mina, to his wife, to his colleagues, and we gleaned an enormous amount of very intimate
information that Freud wrote about himself that seemed absent in most of the most famous biographies. So that was a surprise and also something that was just a gem in terms of writing the book.
Yes, and in the book, you don't shy away from what I imagine was a rather daunting task of writing dialogue, putting actual words into Freud's mouth.
Yeah, well, that turned out to be, this is Jennifer again, mm-hmm. a lot less daunting than we had thought, because he was such a prolific letter writer and so literary and such an expressive, fabulous writer that a lot of that dialogue, believe it or not, he had written himself. And even though in the beginning when we first did it, it sounded a little bit stilted, when you take it out of context, it sounded way more stilted than we wanted to. So we did take some liberties, but in general, most of the things he says, especially about his theories, he is verbatim from the letters.
And how about Mina? Because I understand that there were some missing letters that would have been helpful to have, but how much did you know about Mina going into this?
Well, we certainly knew the background. Freud would write about Mina in his letters. Through his whole life, he called her his closest confidant. And we know that through Martha's letters, the wife, that we figured out the whole dynamic in their home, that the mother had always thought that that Mina was the adventurous one, and Martha was obviously her favorite. And so we got the family dynamic from letters and things that we had read. But as far as the relationship between the two of them, we did have clues. I mean, Martha, Sigmund's wife, actually thought, and famously Sigmund wrote it in his letters to different people, that she thought his work was pornography. And she would have preferred that he be just a little small-town family doctor. It was embarrassing to her, whereas Mina was fascinated by the whole thing. And she would spend nights down in his study, and this is all written, and she would be a voice for him, and he would bounce ideas off her. So we just, through all the letters and the research, you got a feeling of what she was like as a person.
Hmm. On that note, and the book is from Mina's perspective, her point of view, or
yes,
close third person. Would you read to us from the book?
Sure, we'd love to. This is a scene where Mina first arrives at the Freud household. She really has very few options. She's just been fired as a lady's companion, which in those days, they used to say you either had servants or you were one. And Mina was in this kind of netherland as being a domestic, but not really. So her sister had offered a port in a storm. So she had just arrived at the house, and this is the first dinner, which is their lunch, that they had together.
Great.
And Jennifer will read. It certainly wasn't the first time that Mina saw Freud, but it felt that way. He walked in the room and gave her a curious smile. He was handsomer than she remembered, with a heftier build and finer clothes. In fact, he was impeccably groomed, wearing a pinstriped three-piece wool suit and a black silk cravat. There was a simple gold chain, a chain that had belonged to her father, that was attached to his watch, secured through a buttonhole, with the excess length draped across his vest. In one hand, he was holding a small antiquity, a solid bronze figurine, and in the other, a cigar. His hair was thick and dark, slightly graying at the temples, and then there were the eyes, intense, dark, appraising. Mina thought back to when she first met him, a new suitor for Martha. He was standing in the parlor of their home in Vienna, a poor Jew from the wrong side of town, whose family had neither social standing nor wealth. He was looking at Martha, and Mina was looking at him. It was twilight, the time when day and night slur together at a certain moment, and then all the colors of the day fade to black. Her sister had been introduced to him a month before, but by the end of this particular visit, the stage was set for both of them. Martha was almost giddy when she talked about him, but not their mother, a woman from a distinguished German-Jewish family who deemed the young doctor hardly worthy of her daughter. Nevertheless, 2 months later, the couple was secretly engaged. Mina remembered thinking that Sigmund's wild infatuation and pursuit of Martha didn't seem quite real, as if they were playing at being in love, the courtship taking place in both of their minds. The swift progression of it all was baffling, at least to Mina. During these first visits, her sister hardly talked. Martha was a soft, delicate little creature filled with hope, and Mina was a different version of herself as well. Back then, she was tall and thin, all angles and tangled hair. Too much enthusiasm, too much talking, and far too clever. In those days, Sigmund got exactly what he wanted, an old-fashioned sweetheart, not a woman with opinions who engaged in serious conversations. Mina's role was clear from the beginning, and she was ever mindful of that fact. Mina was the intellectual, Martha the intended, and now here they were, Martha and Sigmund married, 6 children, married, married, married. He stood there for a moment watching Mina. She met his gaze, and he gave her the same look he used to give her years ago, making her feel that it was more than simple recognition. Then he crossed the room and took a seat next to her empty chair, placing the antiquity on the table in front of him and snubbing out his cigar. "My dear Mina," he said, "to what do we owe this great pleasure?" "To my getting dismissed," she said, smiling demurely. "Again." That's it.
Thank you so much. That was, I believe that was Karen reading.
That was Jennifer.
I'm sorry. Jennifer Kaufman and Karen Mack are reading from their new novel, Freud's Mistress. And so I love how you snuck the cigar into that scene.
It was in every scene.
Yes. And I heard you in another interview say that Freud didn't believe in birth control and thus the 6 children.
Yes, he thought, actually, he had a lot of theories that were sort of strange when you look back on it. He thought that birth control made the men neurotic, and he was against birth control his whole life. There were all sorts of rumors about whether or not Mina got pregnant during this whole episode. But he definitely was, and that's why Martha would not sleep with him after the 6th child. That was it. There was a gap in his life, so I think Mina filled that gap.
I'm interested in this aspect of you co-authoring the book. And when I heard you both speak at the West Hollywood Festival of Books, you said that by the time one of your books is published, you don't know anymore what Karen wrote and what Jennifer wrote. And it's just hard for me to wrap my head around it. So, for instance, that scene that you just wrote, do you seriously both have the reaction of, oh...
we're looking at each other. You can't see us, but we're looking at each other, and I put my hand up thinking, did I write that? Did she write that? I think that's after so many revisions and so many layers. I think as we're going along, we know who actually, sometimes one of us will come in with a couple pages written as we write in one room together. It's a writer's room. It's very much like they do in Hollywood. It's very common when you write screenplays to have a writer's room. But we do it with a novel. So the night before, one of us will be up till 3 a.m. writing, and we'll bring it in. But then by the time we massage it and put it in, and by the time the book is published, we truly have no... I think there are some sections where we know who wrote who, but in general, it merges together.
So it does sound like a nice arrangement. So we have a built-in beta reader, sort of.
Well, yeah. That's right. I mean, we don't need those reading groups,
right?
Which is kind of tough for a writer. I think there are some writers' groups, and sometimes it works, and other times you just feel like, well, why should I take their advice? So we both respect each other, and we're able to say we hate something in a way that doesn't make the other one angry, and you have to be able to do that, so it works for us.
What was the biggest bone of contention in this? Like, did you have any discussions about point of view, whether it would be in first person or, you know, something along those lines?
You know, we always wanted to do it from her point of view. We've talked to a lot of different authors about this point because there's actually some pretty well-known authors that we're friendly with who have had the experience of writing an entire book in third person, and then the editor says, "This is terrific, but now go back and write it in first person." And or they'll say, go back and write it in first person for the first half and change it to third person. And it's
or from different points of
different
view.
Points of view. But the thing about Karen and I is whenever we have a vision of a story or whenever we start a story, we have it's a pretty detailed vision, and we're in the same we have the same mindset about how to do it and what the voice is. We always, for some reason, and we can't figure it out because we're two extremely different people, but we have the same voice when it comes to fiction. And so this was always in the third-person voice. It was always from Mina's standpoint. It was always looking apart at Freud and looking apart at the situation of women in those days. And we did have some editors that came back and said, wouldn't this be more intimate in first person? But we had a very strong agent that said, let them do it. They're not going to change it.
We're speaking with Karen Mack and Jennifer Kaufman, co-authors of Freud's Mistress. And Jennifer, you just mentioned your agent. So how does that work, the agent representation? Do you have one agent for the two of you, or how does that work?
Go ahead. Yes, well, we actually have this wonderful agent, Molly Friedrich, and I met her years ago. I actually bought one of her books and made it into a miniseries, and we have a very funny story because when we decided to write a novel, I thought, well, I know this agent. I mean, I really hadn't spoken to her in years, but I knew her well enough that we could submit our first 100 pages to her when Jennifer and I first decided we would write our first book. And so she now says that when she got the 100 pages, she said to one of her colleagues in her office, she goes, oh, God, I know this woman. I guess I have to read it. So, but then it went very quickly. We both like her very much. She's just a wonderful agent. And she, in fact, that first novel, she said to us, she goes, with first-time fiction writers, I don't care how much experience both of you have to finish the novel. I've had too many instances where people give me a first 90 pages or 100 pages, and then they can't finish it. So we thought this was very encouraging. We went home and finished the novel, mm-hmm. and then actually she liked it, and she sent it out right after she got it, and over a weekend, and we got 4 bids from 4 different publishers on our first novel. So it went very smoothly for us, but a lot of it had to do with her enthusiasm and how she was a great fit for us.
Wow, no, that's wonderful. And again, about the collaboration, because we were speaking in the first half hour, Barbara spoke with a songwriter who mentioned, you know, collaboration and songwriting, and that's, you know, common and not, you know, unique. And as you mentioned, in the writer's room in Hollywood for TV film, there's a lot of collaboration that goes on there. But in poetry, I mean, I don't think I've ever seen a co-authored poem, and co-authored novels are so, you know, relatively rare. What do you have any thoughts on why that is?
Well, I think I think writing a novel is such a personal thing, mm-hmm. and I honestly don't think I could write one with anyone other than Jennifer. It just somehow worked. It's a good marriage. But there are a few partners. There were two sisters we know where one lived in Hawaii and one lived in Seattle, and they would email chapters back and forth. And then there's some thriller novelists. Of course, James Patterson has co-authors on all his books now, so he's got a whole machine going over there. But for us, it's just a very personal thing, and we just think one and one make four here.
Would you go so far as to recommend that all writers try it, or do you think it's more individual?
Oh, I don't think all writers could try it at all. I have a very good friend who's an amazing writer, and one of our early drafts, I gave it to her to read and give me comments. And she's an amazing writer and a wonderful friend. And I was so resentful of her comments because I thought they were so critical. It has to be a personality where I don't know what the defining role is. I just know it's most likely not able to work on novels.
I think also the fact that it was historical fiction this time was made it a little bit easier than it might have been because the research was so involved and so intense, and it was a couple of years of reading enormous books and biographies and things. So in that sense, it was very helpful to have someone else take part of the load off.
Yeah.
We did divide that up. So we would be reading different things. And as I said before, I went to the Freud Museum in London, and she went to the house in Vienna, which is very interesting because a lot of people, they think of Sigmund Freud, they think of Vienna. But in 1938, Sigmund Freud fled the Nazis, and he was able, because he was world famous at that time, as unlike in our book where he was a struggling doctor, he was world famous by that time, and he was allowed through a lot of help with, you know, the vice president of the United States and diplomats to get everything out. So he took his desk, the famous couch, which I thought was so interesting, the couch, which I saw in person. Wow. Most people have this feeling that it's, and as I've said, everything is in London now, but most people think of a psychiatrist's couch, but his was so lush and seductive, and it was covered with Persian carpets and pillows, and you just wanted to sink right into it.
That must have been a sight.
Yes.
And Karen and Jennifer, thank you so much for joining us. We're drawing down on our time, but before we let you go, do you have any writing advice for our listeners, especially listeners who are considering collaborating?
Well, we always like to say that, Karen and I always like to say that in terms of writing, we have totally different approaches to writing, even though it worked for both of us to work together. And I like to call Karen kind of like a Dickens typewriter, because when she comes in the morning, she would sit down, turn on the computer, and start to write immediately. She would just dive into the empty page. And I was more like a Henry James writer, where I would come in, look at the empty screen on the computer, have a cup of coffee, and then turn away, go to the bathroom, do anything so I wouldn't have to do it. And so it's just either way that you are as a writer, whether you're afraid of the empty screen or you love the empty screen, there's one rule that we both like to say, which is ass in chair.
That, there you have it. Well, Karen and Jennifer, thank you so much for being on the show.
Thank you for having us. Thank
Great.
You.
That was Karen Mack and Jennifer Kaufman, co-authors of Freud's Mistress, published by Putnam. That's all the time we have for today. A huge thank you again for your generous support during our fund drive. Stay tuned for Roots and Rhythms, coming up next on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. Until next time, thanks so much for joining us. Have a great day.